So, you're probably wondering where the hell this has been for 19 months. It's a long story. It involves suspense and details and laughs had by many, and I assume movies of some sort. I think I can condense it down pretty well. So, essentially, what happened. No, wait, I'm telling the story. Welcome, everyone, to Plot Devices Episode 52. The show is alive, even if it has been on ice for a while. My name is Brandon King. I am the host of this movie news and review show for you. Hopefully going back to a regular schedule. That would be a nice change of pace. In case you're new here, this is an essentially pretty straightforward episode to get us back into the swing of things. We've got some movie news for y'all. Some animation wars coming in 2027, some Star Trek movies potentially back in theater. We've got the reviews for movies like Freakier Friday, which we're going to be talking about in a little bit, and I do have thoughts on it. Let's save the pressure for any real strategy and all the stuff like directorial debuts and TV coverage that I do genuinely want to get us back into at some point, but like, why don't we just start off slow for this? My name's Brandon King. We're talking movies on this. If you're listening to this and you have the comment capability, I would love to hear your thoughts below on whatever streaming service you are listening to, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, RSS, some less than legal means. But in all seriousness, if there are any of you from the old show who have stuck around from that time in 2024 down to now and are giving this a listen, thank you. I hope I can put this ship back in the water with as little issue as possible and make this a place for movie fans and beyond, like I always hoped this could build to be, and that I myself am the only one really to blame for why it couldn't be, so this is me trying to get this back to a sense of normalcy. Let's try and talk about some things that are happening. Why don't we do that? Starting off with some trailer news. We're talking Marty Supreme. This is also kind of a big take on an awards conversation right now. This is from, if you don't know, this is Timothée Chalamet's next big movie after Complete Unknown. This is from Josh Safdie of the Safdie Brothers. And it's kind of a big deal, not just in terms of awards consideration, but because this is Josh Safdie's first directing outside of working with his brother Benny since 2008. He did a film called The Pleasure of Being Robbed. He was working with Benny Safdie for many, many years on films like Good Time and Uncut Gems. Then they decided to split. This is essentially going to be the War of the Safdie Brothers this year. Josh is directing this film, Marty Supreme, and Benny is over there directing The Rock in The Smashing Machine, which I'm sure we will be talking about at some point. Very interesting in its own right. As for Marty Supreme, again, Timothée Chalamet's next big role, he's Marty Mouser in this film, based loosely on a real-life person who was a ping-pong player in the 50s, described in the film as, quote, going through hell and back in the pursuit of greatness. It's written by Safdie as well as his longtime collaborator Ron Bronstein, and it maybe has one of the most eclectic ensembles you will see this year. Odessa Azion from the recent Hellraiser reboot, daughter of Pamela Adlon. Severance's Sandra Bernhardt is in this, plus the likes of everyone from Gwyneth Paltrow to Abel Ferrara to Penn Jillette of Penn & Teller to Fran Drescher. Kevin O'Leary from Shark Tank is in this. Tyler, the Creator, is apparently Timothée Chalamet's good friend in this movie. It comes out on Christmas Day. I have been really curious about this one, certainly from an award standpoint, in terms of the Safdies, who seemed fairly close to getting some kind of a real Oscar push from A24 in terms of Uncut Gems a number of years ago, a movie that I don't universally love, but I think Adam Sandler is phenomenal and probably should have been nominated for an Oscar for that. And then you have Timothée Chalamet, who literally in his SAG speech last year was talking about taking the next phase of his career away from sort of teen dramas and things of that nature and becoming, as he called it, one of the greats. And this seems to very much be in that wheelhouse. It's a very, driven, obsessive character drama that seems to have a lot of, you know, snark and heart and really good craft behind it. The cast is just the thing that's throwing me off. It's the thing of, okay, it's Timothée Chalamet, great. It's Gwyneth Paltrow, great. And then it's Tyler, the Creator, who I love as an artist, and who, if you're listening to this, we are in the midst of seeing like A$AP Rocky in Highest to Lowest with Denzel Washington. The idea of rappers being on screen alongside big name dramatic actors is not anything new. It's just a little weird, especially in tandem when you have, you know, Ben Gillette and Kevin O'Leary from Shark Tank as like this ping pong mafia guy, seemingly from the trailer. I don't know any of the real history beyond beyond the real person that this is documented as, but I know it's been circulating around a lot of award circles. The trailer itself does look really fun and exciting. I love the end bit where they're trying to pitch essentially using the Marty Supreme ping pong ball, essentially. I hope that kind of specificity really sinks into this. But yeah, I'm excited for it. It didn't do anything to dissuade my excitement. It's more of a matter of the cast is just so strange. Like, are we going to be talking about Kevin O'Leary for Best Supporting Actor? Like, I don't think I want to be in that conversation. But again, it's Christmas Day. It's supposed to be a wide release, which I would hope. This is supposed to be one of A24's biggest budgeted movies, so they have a lot of faith going behind this. It could very easily turn into one of those Oscar bait dramas that gets all the push behind it and people just don't respond to it. But at least from the trailer, I think we're going to be in a good place for this one. We're now going to move over to the world of Star Trek. I'll be honest, I was hoping the show back, we'd be able to talk about Star Wars because that's more of my wheelhouse, but Star Trek is the big thing in the news because of the Paramount and Skydance merger recently. In case you have not been paying attention to Star Trek World, most of its recent efforts, Star Trek Discovery, Strange New Worlds, those have all been over on Paramount Plus, along with the recent Section 31 movie. It's been nearly a decade since we've had Star Trek in theaters with Justin Lin's Star Trek Beyond. That was the one with Chris Pine and Zach Quinto and Zoe Saldana, the sequel to the 2009 and Into Darkness films. We were supposed to get a fourth film on that, and that sort of almost a parallel with this show was on ice for a long time for a myriad of reasons. Now it looks like Star Trek is actually coming back to theaters. With the latest from that Paramount and Skydance merger, we now have co-film chief at Paramount Josh Greenstein coming out and talking about a lot of Paramount's priorities. Among them, he was talking about things like Top Gun 3 and how that movie is seemingly a priority for the studio. He's talking about releasing hopefully 15 movies per year now, including two theatrical films for Star Trek in development. One of those would be a presumed sequel to Beyond, featuring Kirk, Spock, and the more traditional characters, produced by J.J. Abrams, who did those original films, and written by Steve Yockey, who did The Flight Attendant with Kaley Cuoco on HBO Max a couple years ago. The other film in development is also produced by Abrams, but this would feature all new characters, written by Seth Graham Smith, who did the Lego Batman movie, and directed by Toby Haynes, who's probably best known for his TV work on stuff like Black Mirror, Doctor Who, and Andor Season 1. Interestingly, in those comments, there was no official confirmation that that film with Kirk, Spock, and all those characters would be an explicit sequel to Beyond, so no confirmation that Chris Pine, Zach Quinto, that whole team would be coming back necessarily, but it seems like it would be the case, and especially interesting because there was no listing of a director. Going back to that whole thing of Star Trek IV being on ice for a long time, at various points we've had people like S.J. Clarkson, who did Anatomy of a Scandal, Noah Hawley, who just did the Alien Earth series on FX, Matt Shakman, who just did Fantastic Four First Steps in theaters right now, and even Quentin Tarantino has been attached at some point. Again, going back to earlier when I said I'm more of a Star Wars fan than I'm a Trek fan, that is true. But I've really enjoyed, for the most part, all three of those 2000s Star Trek movies. I just watched the first one, the 2009 one, about a year or so ago, and I was floored by how good it is. Like, I always knew it was a good movie. I always knew that the performances were good and the special effects were stellar, but I hadn't gone back to it in a long time, and it really stuck with me how well they are able to maneuver character arcs and stakes and, again, a sense of excitement to Star Trek that someone like me, who has only watched bits and pieces of the original series and maybe an episode of Next Generation, that is very, for lack of a better word, alien to me. And so the idea of Star Trek becoming this big, exciting, you know, action-adventure movie with a seemingly tonal shift towards the Star Wars side of things, that was right up my alley. And so I now think it's absolutely excellent. Into Darkness is what it is. I think it's a fine movie. I think it's a bit overhated at points, but truly the third act does not do it many favors. Its echoes to Wrath of Khan certainly do it no favors, but I do think there are some excellent performances in there. The score is amazing. And Beyond was so much fun. If y'all did not get to Star Trek Beyond in 2016, I know it was a crowded summer that year, but if you did not get to Beyond, it was a ton of fun. And again, to someone like me who was at the time and still sort of is dipping their feet slowly into what Star Trek is, it was a great exploration of, you know, individualized storytelling that wasn't tied to huge galactic stakes necessarily, but again, had interesting side characters and interesting storylines and great costume design, by the way. But yeah, I really have liked those films. And so I've been looking forward to a fourth entry in that. And if we are finally getting that, great. But again, S.J. Clarkson, Quentin Tarantino, Matt Shackman, Noah Hawley, we have been down this road before. And we have been down this road with Star Trek before. It seemed like for a while they were trying to get four off the ground. And then again, the pandemic happened and the writer's strike happened. So there have been reasons why this hasn't happened. It is reassuring over the years that Chris Pine and Zach Quinto and everyone have been asked seemingly, and they all want to come back, especially with the passing of Anton Yelchin shortly around the time that Beyond came out. I wouldn't blame them at all if they wouldn't feel appropriate coming back to this. But the idea of this happening, yes, absolutely sign me up. Abrams being involved, it depends his extent. I don't think I want him directing this necessarily. I never watched The Flight Attendant, so Steve Yockey's name is completely, again, alien to me. But again, just the idea behind it, if they're actually getting it off the ground, great. But this cast is getting busier and busier and busier, certainly with Chris Pine and Zoe Saldana. Carl Urban is certainly very busy. He's going to be in the new Mortal Kombat movie. So again, it depends what they can do with this. The original one, yes, absolutely. I'm also all for that. I think Toby Haynes is a fantastic choice for this. Andor season one is a masterpiece. I've looked up his episode of Doctor Who. It's a lot of the stuff from like the early Matt Smith years, which I am a big fan of. I haven't watched the stuff on Black Mirror though. Seth Graham Smith is a bit of an interesting choice for a writer. Again, he's written the Lego Batman movie, which is fantastic. He's also written some not so great stuff. I look to like Abraham Lincoln Vampire Hunter. He's done a lot of like uncredited rewrites on like The Flash and things like that. He's been one of those guys who's circulated around Hollywood for a long time and has not necessarily gotten the spotlight to himself every time, which has again lead to like mixed results for perception for people like myself. Again, I'm not ecstatic about the writing choice, but again, like Toby Haynes, I think that's a phenomenal choice. And again, Star Trek in theaters, if we're bringing it back to my love of Star Wars, I can certainly relate to that, where like The Rise of Skywalker did so much damage to a lot of fans' perception. And certainly it did very, very well financially, but it did so much damage to the fandom and the sense of what that franchise could be on screen that it left Lucasfilm really trigger shy to what they wanted to do on screen with it. And that's why they've been mostly relegating, among other reasons, relegating their stories to Disney Plus necessarily. It's one of the reasons that I heard so much criticism around like The Acolyte and The Bad Batch of like, these should be feature-length stories that are Skeleton Crew, another example of just being, you know, stories that were chopped up for the sake of appealing to streaming. And while I cannot speak to Star Trek because I've watched a couple episodes of Discovery, I never watched Strange New Worlds, I didn't watch Section 31, I have heard from as many Star Trek fans as they are who love those series. I have heard from many who would love the series to get back to the idea that it was based on, of exploration and community and a sense of optimism necessarily that maybe those shows aren't offering. And in the wake of movies like James Gunn's Superman, like, as mentioned, Matt Shackman's Fantastic Four First Steps, those are movies that tap into an optimism that I think a Star Trek movie, either with, you know, Chris Pine, Zach Quinto with that team, or with new characters, but taken in that direction, I think could be really interesting. And it is reassuring that even in the midst of all of these shakeups at Paramount and Skydance that we do not have time to get into, but it is certainly reassuring to know that Star Trek is a priority there. And I feel for Star Trek fans who I would hope would be excited about this. So that's just where I'm at with it. And then finally, in terms of movie news today, we foreshadowed a little bit in terms of animation wars that might be going on. This is going to be rather interesting, not this year, not next year, but in 2027. So we start this conversation with where we must always go with good, intelligent conversation, Shrek. Despite my years of cynicism otherwise, Shrek 5 is in fact happening. We got a teaser trailer out earlier this year that was to somewhat mixed fanfare, but supposed excitement from a lot of people. Shrek 2's Conrad Vernon is set to return to direct alongside Walt Dorn, who did the first Trolls movie. They're going to be co-directing this, on top of people like Eddie Murphy, Mike Myers, Cameron Diaz, all coming back to their roles. Zendaya is joining the cast. everything looked pretty much set for this movie. And then came the news that it would be pushed back 6 months from what it was set for, December 23rd, 2026, to where it will now be released on June 30th, 2027. In case you don't have your 2027 calendars up, June 2027 is now shaping up to be a very interesting space for American animation. Basically, if we look down at right now, Pixar is set to release their new original film, Gato, directed by Enrico Casarosa, who just did Luca a couple of years ago. Then the following week, on June 25th, is Spider-Man Beyond the Spider-Verse. So the sequel to Across the Spider-Verse is set for that following Friday. And then the following Wednesday, June 30th, is going to be Shrek 5. So there's a period of around a dozen days or so, right around 2 weeks, where you're getting a lot of potentially high-profile animation projects all in the midst of summer. Not to mention that a couple weeks prior to that is the planned live-action How to Train Your Dragon sequel, which, who knows how that's going to do. The live-action one just from this year has done pretty well so far. It seems logical reasoning that the second one would be as well. It should be noted that the Shrek news comes just a month after Eddie Murphy told Screen Rant that, quote, we are still about 2 years into recording Shrek 5, still in the booth. So it makes sense from that level that it would be pushed back if what Murphy says is to be believed, that they're still knee-deep in voice recording. Animation takes a long time. Notably, Puss in Boots: The Last Wish, related to this, took a long time. Ruby Gilman has taken a long time. DreamWorks has always taken their time, as have most major American animation projects in the last number of years. On the one hand, I think Shrek could have been a really great holiday fare. That said, I think there's the elephant in the room that some of us, i.e. me, don't want to acknowledge, which is the Beyond the Spider-Verse question. Is Beyond the Spider-Verse coming out in June 2027? I would love to hope it would be. By then, it will have been 4 years since Across the Spider-Verse, which is too long if you asked me. This should have been done in 2025, but here we are and we're not getting it for another 2 years. Again, if you can't tell, I'm dying for Beyond the Spider-Verse, as I'm sure many of you are. But I do question how well Spider-Verse will do and how well Sony is looking at Spider-Verse in contrast to Shrek, which is, I think, at this point, almost guaranteed to do about as well as you could ask for DreamWorks. Again, Puss in Boots: The Last Wish did very well. DreamWorks has been on a pretty decent streak. I haven't checked the Bad Guys 2 box office numbers. I'm hoping it's done well because it's really good and you all should see it. But then you also have the question of Gato, which we don't have time to get into the whole are Pixar originals doing well question or not. That's something that I don't feel qualified to just answer speaking into the void of the microphone. But needless to say, I don't think Gato will do gangbusters necessarily, but it will do well. In the same way that Luca should have if it weren't for the pandemic, Gato, I think, will do solid numbers. It will not do gangbusters, and we will be in the same place that we are talking about Elio this year, where it's, is this the death nail of Pixar? Are we in trouble? And we'll have to go through these conversations again, because we do it every time that a Pixar film that's original doesn't make $600 million in its first 2 weeks. Needless to say, back to Shrek. But if we're going back to the wells, and specifically if Mike Myers and Cameron Diaz and Eddie Murphy are back on their A-game for this, by all means, let's do it. I thought the teaser was fine. I didn't hate the animation style in a way that a lot of other people online were talking about. So again, I'm hoping for the best for all three of these because rising tide raises all ships. I'm looking forward to Gato. I think it sounds really interesting. I'm rooting for Enrico Casarosa. I'm dying to see Beyond the Spider-Verse with however much time they're going to take from it. And please, Sony, take your time on it. Give it to us, but please take your time. It's a very double-edged sword with that. And Shrek 5, kind of a similar way, where like, look, this will be something around 13, 14 years after Shrek 4. They have had plenty of time to work this out. So again, it's more of a matter of release strategy. I personally would bet on it doing a little bit better over the holiday season, but putting in the summer, it's probably a smarter move than I'm giving it credit for. I'm more just worried about how its success might affect the other two and the other way around, because I don't need potentially really good, unique animated movies eating each other's success at the box office, which is a sad reality that we are in, but I hope they can all do well. All right, so we're going to take a quick short break. When we come back, we're going to get into reviews. Freakier Friday is in theaters right now. Fixed is on Netflix. And I watched Gravity for the first time in many, many years. Plot Devices will be back in just a minute. All right, everyone, back to Plot Devices, episode 52. We just got through the news segment. Time codes for that are in the description, as well as for all the links and ways to support the show if you would like to. Let's move on to the reviews. And this is probably the most anticlimactic part of the show, because I wanted the show back to have a ton of great things to talk about. And unfortunately, I decided to pick a perfect storm of the week I came back from going home to visit family and friends. I didn't get to see a lot. And also probably the least interesting week in August so far, which, side note, we've had a very interestingly good August this year, but this is maybe the one week where, in terms of new releases and just me being able to get to it, I don't have a ton to talk about. So instead, we're going back about a week or so, and we're starting off with Freakier Friday. This is, of course, the long-anticipated, depending on who you are, sequel to Freaky Friday, the 2003 film from Mark Waters, of course, with Jamie Lee Curtis and Lindsay Lohan, mother-daughter who swap bodies, Tess and Anna Coleman. They don't really understand each other, and shenanigans ensue, and there's a great musical number towards... There's a couple, actually, great musical numbers in that first movie. I like it a lot. I was raised, obviously, with it. I am a child of the late 90s and 2000s. I was required to be. Side note, I did not realize how many Freaky Friday movies there were. There's like 8 of them. There's a 70s movie with Jodie Foster. There's, I think, like 2 or 3 in the 90s. I want to say there was like a DCOM version in the late 2010s. So it's strange. I did not realize how expansive this franchise actually was. But no, this is explicitly a sequel to the 2003 movie. Mark Waters is not back for this one. Instead, we get Neesha Ganatra. Neesha Ganatra is probably best known for doing a lot of comedies in recent years, stuff like Late Night with Emma Thompson and Mindy Kaling. She also did The High Note with Tracee Ellis Ross and Dakota Johnson, Bill Pullman, Ice Cube. Really underrated comedy. I liked The High Note a lot. Late Night, I thought, had the potential to be great, and for various reasons, I don't necessarily think works all the way. But yeah, she is in the director's chair for this one. 20 years have passed since that body swap incident in the first movie. We follow Anna, once again played by Lindsay Lohan, living in L.A., about to get married to Eric, played by Manny Jacinto from The Good Place and The Acolyte recently. Anna and Eric have this kind of meet-cute at a parent conference because their daughters are basically out to kill each other during a food fight at their school. Harper is Anna's daughter, Lindsay Lohan's daughter, played here by Once Upon a Time in Hollywood's Julia Butters, who I did not recognize. She has entirely grown up since that movie. I remember seeing the trailers and thinking, I don't know who that is. And then looking it up and going, that's the kid from Once Upon... Okay. I could not recognize her for the life of me. But again, she plays Lindsay Lohan's daughter here. Sophia Hammonds from Hulu's Up Here plays Manny Jacinto's daughter, Lily. Again, basically, they are from two seemingly different areas of high school. Lily is a transfer student from the UK. Harper is a somewhat outcast, very isolated, who just likes to go out and surf and skip school. Either way, they don't like each other. They start this food fight. Anna and Eric come to the conference. They fall in love. Cut to a montage several months later. They're about to get married. This is the crux of where we find ourselves. And we go to a bachelorette party. We find a psychic played by Vanessa Bayer, who essentially is like you two, i.e. Lindsay Lohan and Jamie Lee Curtis, and you two, the two daughters, need to figure each other out and step in each other's shoes. So another body swap happens, but this time it's between 4 people. So let me see if I'm remembering this right. Okay, Tess, Jamie Lee Curtis, swaps with Lily. Lily swaps with Jamie Lee Curtis's character, and then mother and daughter, Lindsay Lohan and Lindsay Lohan's Anna, and then Harper switch bodies as well. If I'm not explaining it right, go watch the trailer. It will show you pretty much everything you need to. But basically, mother-daughter swapped, mother-daughter swap minds, grandmother, adopted daughter swap minds, and the two daughters say, now that we are adults, we can obviously break up this marriage that we don't want to happen. And the two grown-ups, in their instance, have to go to school and figure out shenanigans and kind of be kids in 2025 with the pros and cons that come with that. Again, shenanigans ensue, there are big musical numbers, all of that. I really did enjoy a good amount of this. And I've said to people, if you adore the first Freaky Friday, and I do know people who absolutely hold that film in high regard, I think you're going to love this. Because if anything else, I really admire the way that Neesha Ganatra and Jordan Weiss managed to transplant some of the zany, wacky, early 2000s, you know, Disney hijinks tone into 2025. It's a very difficult thing to do without just fully delving into full-blown irony territory, and this is genuinely sincere. There are character arcs here, and emotions of all four of our leading ladies who feel sincere and understandable. You have Lindsay Lohan's character, who is a music producer now, who is trying to slowly maybe find her way back to performing live, but she doesn't really feel like she should because she's taking care of her daughter. You have Lily's character, who again has lost her mother. She's been taken to America by her father. She's about to marry into this brand new family with a potential sister who she hates. Like, there are sincere character developments here, alongside these big set pieces with, like, you know, a pop star who Lindsay Lohan's character is mentoring, and this big pickleball sequence with Jamie Lee Curtis and Mark Harmon, who returns as her new husband. A lot of the actual returning cast members are very fun here as well. Like, Chad Michael Murray is back in here. Rosalind Chow is back in here, certainly better used than she was in the first. The real joy in this is watching Jamie Lee Curtis, Lindsay Lohan, Julia Butters, and Sophia Hammonds deal with these different circumstances in the same way that it was fun to just see Curtis and Lohan do in the original and see them try and play each other. Specifically, again, seeing Lindsay Lohan back on screen is really reassuring. No, she's got great comedic timing. She's a really lovely center to her character that she's able to pull out. Jamie Lee Curtis is really fun here. Sophia Hammonds is a great discovery here. Julia Butters does great work here. I will say, because you have double the body swaps, at a certain point, the actors can often sometimes forget which character they're trying to play here, what their actual motivation is. There are moments also towards the third act where the whole will the wedding break up, will it, won't, starts to deal into like really messy melodrama territory where there's a few too many characters that are too important that we should be talking about what they're feeling in this moment. Mark Harmon's character or like Manny Jacinto's parents, like those minor characters who show up should be more important than they are, but we have to focus on, again, the main plot lines. I will also say there are some egregious audio and editing choices in this. Like, some of the cuts in this are just jarring and messy, and they don't help the movie flow. The movie is barely under 2 hours, and it does not feel like it. It feels longer than that. It really doesn't flow all that well at a certain point. Even if some of the high moments do really have a great energy to it, the movie doesn't necessarily use its best elements to build something great. And like, some of the audio stuff, there's some truly terrible ADR choices. Like, you can tell when they were going back to edit these. Like, you can see a face in the corner of a character and there will be a line reading, but their mouth will not be moving. And that happens a lot in this. And it just really drove like the producer side of me absolutely bonkers. But at the end of the day, again, did you like the first Freaky Friday? I think you'll be charmed by this. Like, it has a great energy to it. It has a relatively decent plot to it. It's got some great performances to it. I laughed quite consistently. The whole bit with Chad Michael Murray coming back into the picture is really funny and a great follow-up from the original movie. So I would tell you that in the sense of being a sequel that, yes, is hitting some of the big beats, but isn't necessarily beholden to what its fan base necessarily wants, I think it does a lot of interesting things and has a lot of great subtext to it. It's also a really fun LA movie. I'm curious to see what people who are super familiar with the LA area would think about this, because it is a movie that, for a certain upper class sphere of LA, very much loves the geography and the production design, and it really goes for that angle of it. But yeah, I really did have a good time with this. I wouldn't say it's anywhere near my best of the year, but if you were at all on the fence about seeing it and you have any inclination or love towards the first movie, I think you're gonna have a good time with this. I'm gonna give it a solid 7.5 out of 10. All right, on to our next wide release for the week, Fixed, over on Netflix. This is the return of Genndy Tartakovsky. If the name does not sound familiar to you, I'm sure his work does. He's the showrunner behind Samurai Jack, Dexter's Laboratory, that 2003 2D animated Star Wars The Clone Wars series, all the Hotel Transylvania movies, and he's apparently had this idea for a while, almost 20 years. This was originally made back in, I think, like the late 2010s into the early 2020s, and then around 2024, Warner Brothers, who was doing the film, they announced they wouldn't be doing it. Netflix then wound up picking it up, and so this then premiered at Annecy Film Festival, which is a big animation film festival from earlier this year. Now it's over on Netflix with, a mild theatrical run as well. Bottom line, this is a raunchy as hell adult animated comedy starring Adam Devine as Bull. He is a suburban house dog who likes to, let's say, have fun. The man has a sexual libido beyond most humans. He will hump and screw everything in sight. His crew are very supportive of him, including Idris Elba as Rocco, this sort of British boxer. And then also you have Catherine Hahn as Honey, the sort of would-be love interest of Bull. They've been, you know, friends since they were pups. And all this starts to change when Bull finds out that his family wants to neuter him and essentially cut off his testicles. So he runs away and thus begins a lot of, again, really raunchy, adult, hyper-sexualized misadventures for this dog and his pack and just everything they can find themselves into. I was purely interested in this because it's Tartakovsky. He's one of the people who I think really, especially with the Hotel Transylvania movies as of recently, and beyond just his stuff in the past, I think he understands motion of animation so well. If you go back and watch Dexter's Laboratory or Hotel Transylvania, and you see how his characters move and interact and their expressiveness, he manages to wrangle those characters and those sensibilities together, unlike pretty much any other animation director working today, at least in American animation. And yes, that is foreshadowing that eventually we're going to be doing Hotel Transylvania on directorial debuts. But yes, I really wanted to see what he could do with this. I know this has gone through a lot of production delays, and I want to support him because, again, anytime any of these animation kerfuffles come up nowadays, I am more than often than not on the side of the animators, so I really was curious about this. The trailer was not super promising. It was not getting amazing reviews. And yeah, I kind of concede to that. The movie is not amazing. I will say this. Of what it is going for, in that kind of Sausage Party, you know, hyper-adult kind of lane, I like this more than Sausage Party, I will tell you that, because I think there is a sincerity to the characters. I think there's a liveliness to their adventures and kind of a really great pacing to the movie that, to me, Sausage Party was really... to me, Sausage Party was way more focused on the jokes and the atmosphere than this is. I think Fix is a more put-together movie, which might just be because I like Tartakovsky's storytelling more than I do Seth Rogen and Evan Goldberg. I will say the cast is hit and miss. Idris Elba is surprisingly funny in this. He doesn't get a lot of like pure jokes. He really sinks his teeth into an idea of someone who, if we're going with character arcs, has dealt with a lot of parental issues, has dealt with a lot of friendship issues, and it becomes kind of sincere between him and Bull going on. Catherine Hahn's fine in this. Beck Bennett, who shows up as this show dog who is supposed to breed with Catherine Hahn's character. I know that sounds bad out of the context, but the show dogs are supposed to make babies, essentially. And Beck Bennett shows up from Saturday Night Live as this show dog, and he is just a despicable lunatic. Adam Devine is not great in this. I'd even go so far as to say he's miscast in this. He's the one, and because he's the lead, it makes it really difficult to latch onto Bull as a character. He has this kind of high-pitched range that you can't help but think maybe they wanted Jack Black for this and they got Adam Devine instead. I don't think he can really handle the emotional beats, which Adam Devine has shown himself to do before in stuff like Modern Family. Like, he can handle that. And I don't think he's up for the task here, partly because the movie is so, again, fixated on the animation, which in itself, the animation and the designs and the character expressions are great. Like, I have nothing but props for Tartakovsky and his animation team. They set out what they wanted to make, and it looks super expressive and vibrant, and every character is lively and well-designed. It is just more of a matter of, like, some of the things you see on screen, they are not holding back in this movie. Like, in other words, if you are thinking at all about, like, oh, 2D animation, I'm going to show my kids this. Don't do that. I wouldn't do it. Like, this is way, way, way too mature on that end. This is very much for teens or teens into adulthood. And it knows it. It's willing to do that. And insofar as the story itself on the idea of, you know, losing things that make you yourself and trying to find those elements between, you know, trying to find those parallels between Bull and his impending loss of his testicles, of, you know, Catherine Hahn's character, and she's a show dog and she's trying to figure out what she wants to do with her life, and Idris Elba's character. There are some neat character moments here. It's not necessarily enough for me to recommend the movie wholeheartedly beyond the gimmick of it. And the gimmick of it, really well drawn, really fleshed out, you know, 2D dog movie that is raunchy as hell and will never let you forget it. And if that sounds like your thing, I would essentially tell you, if you watched the trailer for this and it all seemed like it was up your alley, you might be willing to get behind this. And I will admit, there are portions of it where I did chuckle and laugh and say, oh, they're not going to do this. Oh, they asked someone to animate this, and that animator said, okay, I'm going to do that. So in the grand scheme of things, does it work for what it's going for? Yes. Do I want to watch it again? Not necessarily. Would I recommend it? Only if, again, the premise and the aesthetic and the people behind it seem like they'd be up your alley. So for me, I can't remember what I gave Sausage Party going back to that discussion, but like, I think I'd give Fix somewhere around maybe a light 7. That sounds about right. Again, I didn't hate it by any means. I did chuckle when I needed to, and I can firmly look at it and say, this is the movie that, yes, Tartakovsky has wanted to make for almost 20 years, and I applaud him for that, and the characters are neat, and the animation on it, I would almost recommend, as an experiment, watching the movie on silent without the dialogue and the music and everything, just to see what all the characters and their actions and everything presented on screen. It is something to behold. Maybe not something amazing or beautiful, but certainly something. So, again, if this sounds up your alley, Fixed is on Netflix. Check it out if you must. I thought it was okay. All right, so we're going to end the show off on what I hope to be a new segment, whether we have a week like this or not, where we don't have too many reviews to talk about. Essentially, it's called I Also Watched, or I'll Watch. In fact, actually just saying it out loud, that's not a very good title or acronym. We're going to figure it out. If y'all have recommendations for titles or branding, by all means, comment below. Y'all are probably better at this than I am. But it's essentially just a review of something that I caught that I want to talk about that isn't a new release, or in my case, the most recent thing that I saw. In this particular instance, that would be from 2013, Alfonso Cuarón's Gravity. When I came back from being out of town, I managed to just barely catch the encore screening that Harkins Tuesday Night Classics was having on a Wednesday afternoon, because I had seen Gravity about twice. I saw it first in 2013 in IMAX 3D, as it absolutely should be seen. You know, blew my mind, made my retrospective 2013 list, if you want to go check that out. And then I saw it once last, or 2 years ago now, for that retrospective list. But I had not seen it in theaters since I was in high school. And so this was basically an opportunity where I was not going to pass that up if that could be helped. And so I did. I went to go see it. If you are somehow not familiar with this, is Alfonso Cuarón, best known for stuff like Roma and Y Tu Mamá También and the third Harry Potter movie. This was back in 2013, originally developed as a spec script between Alfonso and his son Jonas. It was supposed to have Angelina Jolie and Robert Downey Jr. in it at one point. Both of them wound up dropping out for various reasons. And so in this case, we get Sandra Bullock as the female lead and George Clooney in the Downey Jr. role alongside a couple of small names, most notably Ed Harris as one of the Mission Control guys. Bottom line, if you have not seen it, astronauts go into space. Debris field from a Russian satellite gets blown up, smashes into their shuttle and their laboratory equipment. And so now it is up to these two astronauts to essentially somehow, some way, find their way to safety, if not back on Earth. Sandra Bullock is Dr. Ryan Stone. She's a medical expert who was sent up to the station to help install some new prototype technology that she's been helping with. And George Clooney is Matthew Kowalski, who is a veteran astronaut who, it's his last day before retirement, and you know that means everything good in movies. But he's got this kind of cool head to him. He likes country music. He likes to talk about, you know, old school stories, and it's very much jarring in contrast to Bullock's character, who has gone through tragedy and who is up there purely on a professional basis and who wants basically nothing to do with anything or anyone, not even just the gorgeous view, which turns absolutely horrifying again when that debris field hits and space turns into the deadliest environment you could possibly imagine. I love this film from when I was a teenager. I loved it when I watched in the retrospective, and even though it wasn't, you know, in IMAX necessarily in 3D, and there are certainly scenes where, you know, you watch like a pen float away, or you watch a character zoom into a lens, and you're very much encouraged to think it in 3D if you're not watching it in 3D, I think this is still a phenomenal movie. Like, pretty much, I know there's the sentiment with Gravity that, you know, it's Alfonso Cuarón experimenting with the technology he has on hand, you know, using Emmanuel Lubezki's cinematography to show space in this twisty, claustrophobic, deathly expansive a way, and purely on a technical merit, use that, you know, for audience enjoyment, for, you know, big blockbuster thrills and not much else. And yet I sincerely disagree with that notion, because I found Gravity, especially in this rewatch and the one I had, you know, a year and a half ago, really poignant when it comes to the idea of depression and isolation, and how Alfonso Cuarón and Sandra Bullock, who does not get enough credit for this performance. I really don't think she does. She's absolutely astounding in this, in drawing the line between someone who is universally cold and distant and cut off with someone who on a deep level has to find some meaning of what her life has to be in a place where life has no real meaning. It's space. There's no sound or air or really anything aside from what humans have brought up there. And it's in a lot of the moments of Gravity where we get to see Ryan Stone's character brought to life by Sandra Bullock really toe a really poignant, disturbing, and beautiful line in exploring the ideas of isolation, but not necessarily without hope, of depression, but without being too, you know, cloying or melodramatic. There's a realness to her character that I found deeply deeply and wonderfully affecting. And I would say a similar thing about George Clooney. He is a character who should be terrified at every instance. And, you know, Stone even says as much of, you know, how are you even keeping steady? And he'll turn the conversation because he's been up here enough times. He's been up in space enough times to know that you can't focus on everything going wrong. There's always something to be done. And in that sense, it also ties back to Stone's character really well, of the idea of even if you think you are at your lowest point where you have no one and nothing, there is something to do. There is something to make life worth living. And so purely on a writing level, I really want to commend the movie that I don't think a lot of people do. I think we look at it as this technical marvel, death and destruction in space, and what does that mean for astronauts, and, you know, how can we display that on screen? And to be fair to those people, Emmanuel Lubezki and, you know, the editors and the production design, all of it is in tandem with the visual effects, spectacularly done. The sense of space, not like physical, like outer space, but the sense of space of our characters is so well defined, whether it's, you know, someone floating through the ether and we're told that it's, you know, 100 kilometers away and it feels like a literal ocean away, because it is, because we can see down below at Earth of like, oh, there's like the Sinai Peninsula, and we have to essentially get over to where like Europe is in proportion. Stephen Price's score is so good. And the sound, I was going to say, affects it a lot, but like I jumped to Stephen Price's score because, like, my God, the ending title theme is so good and has been in my head for the last several days of this recording. It's a score that I've always loved, but I've never wanted to go back to, because at times it is so harrowing and at other times it is so serene. And I think Stephen Price has never done anything better, at least up to this point for me. I'm so grateful that I could see this movie. I think if you get the opportunity to see it on a big screen, like I was able to, by all means. But also, if you have just a really good quality television, yes, some of the 3D stuff pops out a bit. Yes, because it's just Sandra Bullock and sometimes George Clooney, it isn't, you know, the most fleshed out world. Like, there was a whole thing in the beginning about like, oh, this will knock out like most of America's communication. And like, we don't really get anything from the ground level of that, minus a really beautiful kind of side plot with Sandra Bullock and this, you know, settler who she essentially contacts miraculously by AM radio. And it leads to this really beautiful scene in a space cabin that is kind of the idea of like random strangers connecting. But beyond that, it's very much you are isolated and stuck with this and you have to be with it. And because Alfonso Cuarón is so good at keeping the eye on the situation at hand, it leads to a movie that is, again, deeply affecting if you're viewing it through a lens that I similarly am. But even if you're not, it's so well-crafted and so in tune with its environment and what it needs to go for that you almost can forgive it for most of its other flaws. I do genuinely think this is a tremendously good movie that is often overlooked by how good its technical elements are, which are spectacular, by the way. Even 12 years later, this is still one of the best-looking space movies of this millennia, I think. But yeah, I truly think this movie is astounding. It's maybe not Alfonso Cuarón's best. I would still put Roma up there. But yeah, this is truly spectacular. Maybe if I really thought it through, I'd downgrade it to a 9. But I think this is genuinely excellent and sometimes gets misconstrued, but I really think there's beauty in a lot of the horrific, huge spectacle in there that, especially on this third viewing for me, back in theaters, really sat with me really well on. Okay, so I guess we made it through an episode. Again, we kept it pretty bare bones today with just news and reviews, but like, we did it. If you're listening to this, it's up and running. I hope you enjoyed it. Again, that was episode 52. If you liked it and you want to follow the show and just see if we keep this going, because I really would love to try and keep this up going, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, RSS feed, search for Plot Devices. We are on there. Give us a follow. Give us a rating if that's applicable. And again, comment below on what you think on any of these topics. And I'll actually issue the discussion question right now, going back to our Shrek discussion. What is your favorite DreamWorks movie? Is it the first Shrek movie? Is it How to Train Your Dragon? What is it? If you want to follow my misadventures for whatever reason, I'm on Twitter, Instagram at TheMovieKing45, and Blue Sky at BDK45.bsky.social. Plot Devices will probably be on Blue Sky at some point as well. All of those links and episode time codes and news sources, those will all be in the description as well if you're curious. And again, come back next week. We'll hopefully have another one for you. If you tuned in, again, thank you so much for being patient. Please be a part of this community. We'd really love to have you here. My name is Brandon King for Plot Devices, and I'll see you next time.